Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, among many other things. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, his Numero Uno podcast, his Numero Dos podcast, the Jimmy Akin podcast that drops each Monday. What dropped on Monday this week, Jimmy?
This week we had a look at the Antichrist. It was our 66th episode, and I had a listener who wrote in and asked about the Antichrist, so I said, I'll do that.
Excellent idea. Yeah.
Talked about the Antichrist coming up this Monday. I had another listener write in and say, what are we supposed to do at the sign of peace? You know, since COVID, not a lot of people want to shake hands. So they wanted to know what to do. And so I went through the law. I went through all of it in, you know, all the passages in the general instruction of the Roman Missal that talk about the individual exchange of the sign of peace, some of which are rather surprising in what they say.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. There are things about this individual exchange that a lot of people don't know. And then I talked about different options for what you can do. I mentioned, you know, what I do and talked about the religious significance of that. But it'll be an interesting look at the sign of peace for those who would like more information about it. And that comes out this Monday.
All right. Check it out. Jimmy Akin's page on YouTube or just look for the Jimmy Akin podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. When we went to the break, we were talking with Mackenzie, who was not able to stay on the line, Mackenzie in Pasco, Washington. But I was asking about infant baptism, and there was more you wanted to get to. So I'm going to just let turn it over to you.
So we talked about the historical development of the practice of infant baptism, and then we moved on to what does to the more theological part of his question, which was what does original sin mean? Because he has the correct understanding that in the Catholic view, baptism will cure original sin if it hasn't already been cured by God's grace. And I pointed out that original sin, despite the name, does not in Catholic circles refer to a personal sin. You have not done anything that would, if you're an infant, that would, would offend God. And consequently, you would not be sent to hell on account of original sin. And in fact, the Catholic Church understands that God can provide grace to people apart from the sacraments. So the Catechism of the Catholic Church, for example, says that we may confidently hope that God can provide salvation to children who die without baptism. And some subsequent documents have even gone a little further than that. So I would say that it seemed like Mackenzie's question was being motivated by a clash between the Catechism say, or the Catholic Church saying it respects the dignity of all life, and yet there are these kids who die without baptism and would go to hell on that account, and that is not Catholic teaching. So that's the answer to the theological core of the question. I wish Mackenzie had stuck around because I wanted to see what he would say in response to at least based on the way the question was initially posed to us in, you know, the call screening. I wanted to see what he would say if I posed a counter question. Now, he said from an LDS perspective, and I assume that means he's a member of the LDS Church or the Mormon Church, as it's commonly called. And I would say, well, wait a minute. Let's take the issue of going to heaven off the table, because he expressed the opinion that children dying without baptism would make it to heaven. And Catholics can agree to that. The Catholic Church doesn't teach they definitely, for sure, 100% all go to heaven. But that may well be the case. So the Catholic Church doesn't have a difference there. But the Catholic Church would also say that besides that, besides just the issue of do you get to heaven or not, God does give his grace through baptism. And there are other benefits besides salvation, like becoming part of his son's church, becoming part of the body of Christ. Well, okay, let's think about, since McKinsey was talking about how things look from the Mormon perspective, let's look at the same situation in a Mormon context. Would he say that the Mormon church says it respects the dignity of all life, born and unborn? I suspect he would agree with that and say, yeah, the Mormon church does, the LDS church does respect the dignity of all life, born or unborn, human life. Okay, so if we take salvation off the table because we don't have a substantive difference here, does the Mormon church agree that besides merely not going to hell or outer darkness in Mormon terminology, are there other benefits to being baptized that that one receives when one receives Mormon baptism? And I'm pretty sure he would say the answer is yes, because in addition to getting forgiveness of sins, it's also believed that you need to be baptized in order to receive full spiritual development in the afterlife, you know, like becoming a god and so forth. You, on the Mormon view, you need to have baptism for that. And they're so persuaded of this that even for people who have died in a state of grace where they're not going to go to outer darkness, they try to do posthumous baptisms, after death baptisms for these people via a proxy. You have someone else who's a proxy. That person comes into a Mormon temple. They baptize them on your behalf if you say died as an infant without baptism. Now, it would seem your salvation is not in question from a Mormon perspective. You know, you haven't gone to outer darkness, but they would seem to acknowledge that you can still need, even if you died as an infant, you would still need to get baptized for reasons other than salvation, and that's why they do proxy baptism for you after your death. So I would say, is there a contradiction here on the part of the Mormon church? The LDS Church, between saying that it respects all life, all human life, born and unborn, and the idea that infants who are in danger of death or dying or have died still need baptism for benefits other than salvation, because we both have our own version of what those benefits are. But I suspect he would say, well, in the case of the LDS Church, I don't think it does have a contradiction. And if there's no contradiction for the LDS Church saying it respects all life and there are reasons other than salvation that you would want someone baptized, like if they died as a child without it, then the same thing would be true for the Catholic Church. It can still respect all human life, born and unborn, and say that people need to be baptized as in order to receive other benefits besides salvation itself. The difference is the Catholic Church does not practice after-death baptism by proxy. So you want to, therefore, baptize infants on the Catholic view.
McKinsey, again, we will say thank you for that call and the question. Let's take a quick break, Darren, and then we'll come right back. That'll be perfect. We'll get set, and we've got only one line open right now, so we'll get right back to those calls. 888-318-7884. Right back with more Jimmy Akin.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
With news from EWTN's Rome office, you can watch all the important events from Rome, even if you don't have TV access. Using the latest technology, we've made it possible to watch the latest news from the Holy See, all delivered directly to your home via live streams. Watch live on EWTN's YouTube channel and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. You can call and ask Jimmy whatever you like, but all the lines are full at the moment, so let's get some answers before I give out the phone number again. Dan is in Hayes, Kansas, listening on Divine Mercy Radio. Dan, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Cy and Jimmy. Thanks for being on. Thanks for everything you guys do.
Well, thank you, Dan.
I really love what you guys do. Real quick, so I'm a cradle Catholic, and I kind of struggle with understanding the hypostatic union. I understand that Jesus possessed the entirety of his divine nature and the entirety of his human nature from the moment of his incarnation. But, you know, there's Luke chapter 2, where Jesus increased in wisdom and stature, and Hebrews 5, he learned obedience through what he suffered, you know, and various other things. So my question is, what did Jesus, the human being, know when he was 5 years old or 10 years old? If I were to sit down and have a conversation with 5-year-old Jesus, would it be like the woman at the well, where he could tell me everything that I ever did?
Okay, well, that would depend on whether he used his divine power to get that information about you. But let's back up, and I'm going to give you a source that you can use to find the church's teaching on the principles that apply in this area. That source is the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and specifically, you want to look at paragraphs 472 through 474. These are on Christ's soul and his human knowledge. Now, of course, in his divine knowledge, he was omniscient. He knew everything. And that's an infinite amount of knowledge. But according to paragraph 472 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, this human soul that the Son of God assumed is endowed with a true human knowledge. As such, this knowledge could not in itself be unlimited or infinite. It was exercised in the historical conditions of his existence in space and time. This is why the Son of God could, when he became man, increase in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. That's the passage from Luke that you mentioned. And would even have to inquire for himself about what one in the human condition can only learn from experience. This corresponds to the reality of his voluntary emptying of himself, taking, quote unquote, the form of a slave, which is a quotation from St. Paul. So in his divine, the principle they're laying down here is in his divine knowledge, Christ knows everything. That's dealt with in another paragraph. But here in paragraph 472, it's talking about his human knowledge, and it says this is finite. And it was exercised in a certain set of historical conditions. And that's why Jesus, since it's finite, that's why he could grow in wisdom and stature. So he would at age 5 be expected to have the knowledge an ordinary 5-year-old. He would at age 10 be expected to have the ordinary knowledge of a 10-year-old. This would be, knowledge he had absorbed from his historical setting, just like other children of his day and age at ages 5 and 10 would have absorbed their knowledge from their historical setting. But he also had something more than that. You mentioned how with the woman at the well, he has this preternatural knowledge of you've had five husbands and the guy you got right now isn't actually your husband. Well, okay, that's dealt with in the next paragraph of the Catechism, which says, but at the same time, this truly human knowledge of God's Son expressed the divine life of his person. The human nature of God's Son, not by itself, but by its union with the Word, meaning his divine nature, knew and showed forth in itself everything that pertains to God. Such is first of all the case with the intimate and immediate knowledge that the Son of God made man has of his Father. The Son in his human knowledge also showed the divine penetration he had into the secret thoughts of the human hearts, So the first part of that about having immediate knowledge of his Father, well, that's something he would have had in his human knowledge at age 5 or 10, because we see him having that knowledge at age 12. If you look in Luke chapter 2, where they find him in the temple, he tells his earthly parents, well, didn't you know I'd have to be in my Father's house, meaning the temple? So he's already displaying a unique understanding at age 12 of his relationship to the Heavenly Father. And I don't think that's something that flashed into his mind for the first time at age 12. I think he grew up having this insight, and then as he learned Aramaic, which he would have picked up from his environment just like other children, he learned how to more precisely express the intuition he had of his relationship to the Father. But then it says the Son, in his human knowledge, also showed the divine penetration he had into the secret thoughts of human hearts. And it cites various examples of him doing that if you look at the footnote. And I since his fundamental abilities as the incarnate Son of God do not change over time, I would say he would have that knowledge as well when he chose to have it. So there are some situations where he needs to ask information like, who touched me? But then there are other situations where he focuses on a person and says, oh, you've done this and this and this. And so would he be able to tell you all the things you've done if you had a conversation with him at age 5 or 10? Well, but if by can you mean or could, is it possible for him to do that? Yes, it's possible. But it would require him to tap into his divine knowledge, or at least his psychic powers, to be able to do that. On the other hand, he might not have that knowledge queued up. Like when the woman with the hemorrhage touches him, he doesn't initially know it's her. And he has to ask about that because he has not tapped his omniscience to figure out who it was that touched him. He chose to get that knowledge a different way. And so if he chose to get information about you from his divine nature, he could do that at age 5 or 10, but he might not automatically do that, in which case he wouldn't have that information in his human knowledge without choosing to have that information in his human knowledge.
Okay, Dan?
That's good. That's a big subject and helps me to get there a little bit. So thank you.
Awesome.
Very good.
Thank
you, Dan.
And check out those paragraphs in the Catechism and you can think about them and the principles they articulate.
All right. Up next, Jonathan in Oceanside, California, listening on our website, Catholic.com. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back. You got a question for Jimmy?
Hello. Thank you for taking my question. My question today is, could you explain and help me to understand the differences between preternatural and supernatural?
Sure. And it's interesting. I just used the word preternatural, which is not the most common word, in the previous phone call, which could mean I'm psychic, or it could just mean I saw that word coming up on the call screening list and decided to use it. You decide. Okay. So, preternatural and supernatural both have the word natural in them. And natural has, it can mean a few different things. What it means in this case is either what happens ordinarily in the natural world, like, you know, rain is a natural phenomenon under certain weather conditions, or human nature. You know, human nature is under ordinary conditions is to be able to walk, but not to be able to fly. So you can take natural either in the natural world sense or in the human nature sense. The key for distinguishing between these two terms is that front part of the word, praeter and super. Praeter is a Latin preposition that means apart from or beyond or things like that. So what's preternatural is something that happens that is beyond nature or apart from nature. It's something that either human nature or the natural world would not accomplish on its own. And I'll come back to that to clarify. But super is a Latin preposition that means above. And so so it would mean something that is above nature. It's the origin of something is above what the natural world could do or above what human nature could do. Now, that's the etymological origins of these two words. They mean beyond or apart from nature and above nature. But word origin does not exhaust meaning, and so I want to go a little further to explain how these terms have come to be used. And the place I want to start is with the term supernatural. Now, the way that a lot of people today use the term supernatural is it's anything that, and it's not very well defined, but they would categorize a lot of different things as supernatural. Like if God does something, Psychelet, is that supernatural?
Yes.
Okay. How about if an angel does it?
Yes.
How about if a saint does it?
Well, I mean, like a canonized saint, yes.
Yeah. Well, what if they're not canonized? What if they're just a saint in heaven?
Well, I was thinking there could be saints on earth, but I'm, yes.
I'm talking heavenly ones. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So you would, in this case, be using the term supernatural quite broadly to indicate something. Let me ask you one more.
Yeah.
You agreed that if a demon does it, if an angel does it, it's supernatural. How about a demon? Because they're the same thing as angels.
I honestly don't know what to say to that one. I think I would probably say yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is a fair, you know, being a linguist, I'm not judging how people use words. I'm just trying to establish how they use words. And so I would say, yeah, this is a common use of the term supernatural. You know who doesn't use it this way a lot of the time? Theologians. Much of the time in theology, theologians will restrict the term supernatural to just stuff that God does. So stuff angels do doesn't count, stuff demons do doesn't count, stuff saints do doesn't count. It's only God. And historically, when they would judge, is a Marian apparition of supernatural origin, what they meant was, is God doing this Marian apparition? Theologians therefore would need another term to describe what an angel does or a demon does or a saint does. And the term they used was preternatural. So, they would say if God does something, it's supernatural. If it exceeds what the natural world can do or what human nature can do, then it's preternatural. So you have basically three categories: natural, preternatural, and supernatural, where supernatural is God does it, natural is what the world does or human nature does, mm-hmm. and then preternatural is what anybody else does.
Okay, Jonathan.
So that's a basic distinction, set of distinctions.
Jonathan?
So if I understand it correctly, so preternatural is kind of like of nature, but are able to do supernatural things?
No, on this understanding, preternatural means it's something that nature can't do. Either the natural world will not do it on its own, or human nature will not do it. It is apart from nature or beyond nature in terms of what caused it. So if, let's say, an angel causes it to rain when there is no moisture in the sky whatever, well, because since there's no moisture in the sky, the natural world can't make it rain, and humans can't make it rain when there's no moisture in the sky. I mean, we could cloud seed if there was moisture, but if there's no moisture in the skies, humans can't do it either. They'd have to get moisture in the air from some means. So since it's an angel doing this in this case, it would be preternatural. It's beyond what nature can do. And if God did it, if God made it rain when there's no moisture in the sky, then that would be supernatural.
And that brings us to the natural break in the show. We got to take a quick break. So, Jonathan, I will leave it there. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. If you have a question for Jimmy, it's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. And as you can tell from the questions, Jimmy takes that quite seriously. You can ask anything you'd like, 888-318-7884. Don't forget the big sale going on, the 26% off. If you use the promo code SAVE26 over at shop.catholic.com, we want you to get your reading materials, or maybe viewing materials, whatever kind of materials you're looking for, get them over at shop.catholic.com to get ready for Lent. 26% off everything in the store. If you spend $26 and you use the promo code SAVE26, shop.catholic.com. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Groovy music. Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin. What a combination. 888-318-7884. We're going now to Leander, Texas. Mary, watching on YouTube. Mary, I think you've been waiting a while. Thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. Thank you. Jimmy, you have been very helpful to me. I just finished my master's degree. I'm looking mostly for, like, research help.
Out of curiosity, what was your master's degree in?
It was in classical education and liberal arts at Belmont.
Okay.
And you helped me a lot through that, Jimmy. Mm-hmm. I listen to your podcast all day long. So.
Oh, great.
But this question, I can't find and I need help. Here's the scenario. Person A invites person B to live with them. Person B goes from recovering from a cult, becomes Catholic. Person B has a rock collection. Rock collection includes those crystals that you find sometimes in those jade shops. Could person B put them in glass containers and at various times of the moon phase, lets them sit outside? Person A is unaware of that until recently, trying to figure out why stuff keeps flying around the house. Does person A need to get church involved? Is person A losing their mind? Is this just overreaction? Is it okay? It's just rocks. This person B doesn't actually do anything in front of the rocks. There's no weird ceremony. She's also just baptized Catholic recently. She says it's just a rock collection. But it's the putting it outside at the various moon phases part that has person A's attention.
Okay, I need to ask some follow-up questions to make sure I understand this.
Sure.
You know, you were using ciphers for the two people, calling them person A and person B. Is it person A who owns or rents the property where the two of them are living?
Person A owns the home. Person B is just living there.
Okay, and it's person B who's living there who owns the rock collection, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and person B is the one who puts it out under the moonlight and so forth.
Correct. Also, the state they live in does not allow person A to get rid of person B's belongings, even though they may not necessarily agree with them.
Well, I understand that. I mean, if I was rooming with someone and they wanted to throw away my computer without my consent, I would be mad too.
Correct.
You know, the solution there wouldn't be to get rid of the computer without the person's consent. It would be to say, I'm afraid you either need to move out or you at least need to move your rock collection somewhere else because I don't want it in my house and I do own the house. But I don't know that things need to come to that point because I have another question. You said stuff is flying around the house. Is that actively happening today?
Oh boy, Jimmy.
I mean, not today, but you know, is it currently going on?
In this hypothetical situation, that dwelling has been blessed by a priest at least three times during this interval. A wasn't sure what was causing it. So, happening.
It is still happening. Okay. How long has it been happening for?
Since person B moved in.
Which is how long in time?
Couple years,
okay. Have you seen the stuff moving, flying around?
There's also, it's more than just that. I just want to be clear. There's also
that's fine. Tell me what's happening.
Voices and things.
Okay. Voices.
Okay, Jimmy. there's voices. There's choking. There's scratching.
Okay.
The day after the last blessing, couldn't figure out why I was getting choked in my sleep. Found out. I think it's that, but I don't know.
Okay. Well,
I'm not crazy, and your demons episode has helped me so many times, and I don't want to be one of those Catholics who's like, it's always demons. I'm not that person.
Okay. Good.
I want to be mythological and intelligent here.
Okay. So I would say, based on what you've described, that I can see a number of possibilities for what's happening here. Some of them are natural possibilities that where it may look like something is, you know, paranormal going on, but it may not be. It may just be normal. Also, it's possible that something paranormal is going on. If it's being produced by humans, it would not have anything to do with the rock collection, not directly anyway. It could be a case of what's known as recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK. Psychokinesis is mind over matter. which can explain not only, you know, stuff flying around the house. It can explain voices, because voices are physical. You know, they're vibrations in the air. It can explain choking and scratching and things like that. So we've got something that would be psychokinetic in nature if it's paranormal. It also has happened spontaneously, meaning no one's trying to make it happen. It's just happening spontaneously. And it happens in a recurrent way. It's been keeping happening over a period of 2 years. And so that suggests it could be recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK, or what is more commonly called a poltergeist. Now, one of the things about RSPK is it's been observed to occur when people are under stress. And the theory, based on observation, is that they don't feel, even though they're under stress, they don't feel they can fully express that stress. And so their subconscious kind of vents their worries and frustrations psychokinetically. And there are ways of finding out, is that the case? Like if you can find ways to get the stress off the person and the RSPK goes away, well, that would suggest that it was the stress causing it. And there are various ways of helping people get stress management and make changes in their lives to remove the stress and so forth. On the other hand, it's possible you could have a nasty spirit here. So all of those are possibilities. I would say if it's not natural, it would be more probably RSPK, because evil spirits harming people is rare. That's extremely rare, although it does happen. So those are kind of the three basic options, you know, natural, RSPK, or evil spirit. In order to tell you which is the case, I would have to do an investigation. That's not something that can be diagnosed over the phone. So not just in a short, you know, radio conversation. So if you would like to pursue this further, I would be happy to discuss this with you off the air. You can email me at Jimmy, J-I-M-M-Y, at Catholic.com. And we can pick it up off the air, and I'd be happy to provide whatever assistance I'm able to.
That would be amazing. I don't mind waiting to talk to you further.
All right. Mary, if you would just hang on the line, and you can give your information if you'd like to Edgar, and we'll get it to Jimmy, okay?
Thank you so much.
All right.
No problem.
Mary, thank you very much. We'll go to the break. Be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Now, some people, they seem to be born angry. I mean, they're kicking and screaming from day one. And if you say something to them, they say, well, that's the way I was made. Applesauce. Nobody was made angry.
Mother Angelica Live Classics. Every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Well, we said ask me anything, so you never know. 888-318-7884, the number here. Let's go to Isabella in Pierce, Nebraska, watching on YouTube. Isabella, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So I'm wondering, I'm reading Rescued by Father John Ricardo, and
okay. I don't know who that is, but okay.
He says in his book that most parts of Genesis are figurative. And so I was wondering, if it's not like the snake and the fruit and all of that, how did original sin actually come about?
Okay, you mean like what would you see if you stepped in a time machine and went back to the event? The answer is we're not sure. Now, first of all, I have a caution about saying most stuff in Genesis is figurative. I don't know that I would say most stuff in Genesis is figurative. I would say with Pope Pius XII that the first 11 chapters use simple and metaphorical language to communicate various truths, but that doesn't mean most stuff in Genesis is figurative. I think once Abraham comes on the stage in chapter 12, it becomes much more historical. That's not to say everything is literal, because all history, and especially all ancient history, is written according to certain conventions that can involve, you know, things like reconstructed dialogue and so forth. But certainly the creation narrative and the fall narrative in Genesis 3 is something that is in the part of Genesis that uses a good bit of symbolic or metaphorical language. In terms of exactly what happened, the Catechism of the Catholic Church provides at least a little bit of guidance on this. If you look in paragraph 390 of the Catechism, it says the account of the fall in Genesis 3 uses figurative language, but affirms a primeval event, a deed that took place at the beginning of the history of man. Revelation gives us the certainty of faith that the whole of human history is marked by the original fault freely committed by our first parents. So that tells us that at the beginning of the history of man, a deed took place, an action took place, where our first parents freely committed a fault. And that's about the limit now in terms of what we know. What that fault was, you know, is depicted under the symbol of Adam and Eve eating the forbidden fruit. Exactly what that corresponds to, though, is something that the church has ruled people are free to speculate on. But in some way, our first parents decided to disobey God. They did something they shouldn't have that is pictured as eating the first fruit when God had told them not to. That could have been all kinds of different things. It could have been any sin that people, you know, have committed in the history of the world could be what you would have seen if you had gone back in a time machine to witness the event. And so there are loads of options. What the important thing is not specifically what it was that they did, but that they did something they shouldn't have. They knew via their consciences or God's revelation or something, they knew what they should do, and they chose not to do it anyway. And that has marked the later course of human history. So I can't tell you exactly what you would see if you went back to witness the event, but I can tell you the important thing. The important thing is they knew what they should do, and they chose not to do it.
Isabella?
What?
Does that get to what you were asking? All right. Thank you very much. On we go, because we are not running out of callers, but we are running out of time. Christian is in Virginia watching on YouTube. Christian, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, hi. Good evening from Virginia. So I guess I had a question for Jimmy Akin, right, in regards to Our Lady of Fatima, right?
Okay.
And it's kind of
good,
because like
Jimmy Akin's the one who's
time,
here.
But I guess that to condense it as much as possible, right?
Yes, please.
Would you say, Jimmy Akin, that the more that one learns about the apparition and the evidence behind it, would one come to the conclusion that it actually happened, or to the conclusion that, or to a more skeptical or agnostic conclusion in regards to
Well, I would say that now you phrased it in terms in comparative terms. You said if one learns more about the apparition, and that, you know, you're thus comparing what one knows at after that process than one knew at the beginning of the process. That's what the learning more is. You know, what conclusion one's going to come to is dependent on a variety of factors. And I hesitate to say, oh, the more you know, the more convincing it is. You may hit a certain point where you've already got all the good data, and learning more than that doesn't really affect the evidential balance. So I'd be disinclined to use language saying, oh, yeah, the more you know, the more convinced you are, or the less convinced you are. What I would say is that there is really good data that that Fatima was a supernatural apparition. And if you learn that data, you will find very good reasons for thinking that Fatima was a genuine private revelation. And in fact, Cy Kellett and I, just in the last 3 weeks or a couple weeks, had an episode looking at Marian apparitions and ranking them. And Fatima came in second highest on the scale of the ones we looked at. It came out on January 1st.
Oh, January 1st. Okay.
Yeah. The Marian feast day.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, you can check out that for what I had to say. That's not a complete analysis. If you want a fuller analysis, you could look at the 3 episodes of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World that I devoted to this question. I think they're episodes 40, 64, and 65. You can go to my YouTube page, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin, and using the search feature for my page, not the YouTube search feature at the top, but the one for my YouTube channel that's below that. Just type in Fatima, you'll get several hours worth of analysis. And there are fuller analyses. You know, people have written books about this, some of which I mention in those episodes. But I would say that unless you're a priori closed to the possibility of a supernatural revelation, there is good evidence for Fatima being a supernatural private revelation.
Mm-hmm. And would you also say that, at least in regards to like people that are already Christian, and especially the ones like in the more like non-Catholic circles, do you think when they make the claims that it must have been a government hoax, a delusion, or a demonic experience, do those hold up under scrutiny?
Well, I don't know how the government would have hoaxed it in 1917. You know, so I would say that's very implausible. We didn't have hologram technology in 1917. In fact, we don't even have good volume. What the technical kind of technology you need is what's known as a volumetric display. And we don't even have good volumetric displays now. So I don't see how a government hoax would be responsible. When it comes to it must have been demonic, that is not what the evidence is telling you. If someone holds that view, it's their theological views that are telling them that, because they don't believe in private revelation, or at least they don't believe in Catholic private revelation. And so if you have something that is preternatural, you know, that's happening apart from what the natural world or human nature would produce, then, and you have ruled out the idea that it's coming from God, well, then demons are about the only thing left. But it's really the theological beliefs that either private revelation doesn't happen, or that Catholic private revelation doesn't happen, that would lead you to reject an apparent Catholic private revelation. That's theology. That's not evidence of the, you know, what would we find if we interviewed witnesses and you know, looked for possible causes of what they saw and reported. That's your theology. That would be their theology talking. What is more interesting is the middle claim that you mentioned, that there is a natural cause for this somehow. And that's something that needs to be investigated. You know, there are natural causes that can be responsible for various reports of private revelation. There are a variety of those. There can be misperception. There can be misinterpretation. There can be mental illness. There can be outright hoax. And so, it's anytime you have a report of something paranormal happening, you want to think of every possible explanation, including natural ones, and then go through them and see what the evidence fits. In this case, the church authorities did go through a lot of possible alternative explanations, and they concluded that when they looked into alternative explanations, they didn't find any good ones. It looks like this is something that is genuinely of God. And based on my own review of the evidence, I would agree. I think the best explanation, even though nothing, you know, it's not impossible that something else was going on, that the best explanation that best fits the data is that this was a genuine private revelation.
Christian, again, I will say thank you to you because I do want to try to get everybody on if I can before we have to go. Philip is in St. Louis, Missouri. Philip, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. I was just curious, like, because I even asked a priest about this. So what is, like, our love for God considered? It's not, like, unconditional love that I know of. I know, like, God's love for us is, like, you know, eternal kind of thing. But, like, what would our love for God be? Because, like, we have love a neighbor, you know, and then there's the first commandment. So, like, what would the term be for us loving God? And, like, why would it be that way?
Well, I'm not sure what conceptual scheme you're using to map different types of love. So I'm not 100% sure of how to answer the question. I mean, obviously, the term.
I wasn't sure how to phrase it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem. Obviously, it is love. Otherwise, it's something that can be meaningfully called love. Otherwise, Scripture wouldn't use that term in explaining the first and great commandment. I would say that fundamentally what it means is God and His will are our highest priority. Since we're finite creatures, we can't love God with infinite intensity, you know, at any given moment, but we can recognize that God is infinitely valuable and thus infinitely lovable. And even though we're finite creatures, we can make Him our highest priority and say, if anything else conflicted with God, I would choose God. And that is something a finite being is capable of doing. So that's sort of how I would explain our love for God in a mechanical sense of what are we actually doing when we're fulfilling the great commandment. It basically means we've made God our highest priority. Beyond that, I would have to know more about the conceptual scheme that you're using to classify different types of love. One thing that I hesitate about is the use of the term unconditional love. This term is a buzz phrase. Now, it's not something Christians have always talked about. This is a recent term that has gained a lot of popularity, and especially in the latter half of the 20th century, it basically became a buzzword in psychology about, you know, how you need to give other people unconditional love. Well, okay, there's a truth there, but the truth is often presented in a way that is distorted. And that leads to false conclusions. It's true that I need to, whether the person I'm loving is good or not, I need to will their good. But that doesn't mean that I need to constantly have rosy feelings towards them. And it doesn't mean that I need to ignore things they've done, or I need to refrain from ever punishing the person so that they'll learn their lesson, or refrain from punishing the person so that they can't hurt others. None of those ideas are in conflict with the idea of what could be called unconditional love in a good sense. But you often hear people kind of getting sloppy with that term. And so I recognize that there is a truth of unconditional love, both in regard to us and other persons and with regard to God's love for us. But there's also a conditional aspect of God's love. You know, if you just sin and sin and sin and choose to live eternity apart from God, well, then you will. He's not going to force you to be with him. And so in that sense, his love is conditional, but in another sense, it's unconditional. And so I just have a caution about the use of this term.
Philip, that you probably can hear the music. That will do it for us. So thank you for the questions. I apologize to a couple people that were on the line, but I mean, Jimmy did yeoman's work today. So we did the best we could. Call another time. Jimmy, thank you very much for two very fine hours.
Thank you for all the yeomen in the world. I salute you.
Yeoman, wait, what was the one on Star Trek? What was her name? Yeoman?
Janice Rand.
Yeoman Janice Rand. That's where I learned the word yeoman. All right, we'll see you next time. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.